This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Immigration and race are two issues that could be critical to the 2020 presidential election. That's according to 90.7 political commentators Dick Batchelor and Frank Torres. We sat down to talk about how the race looks more than a year out from the election and the role that Florida will play in deciding who will be the next president. First, though, I asked Republican political commentator Frank Torres about the Florida Bar's review of a tweet sent by U.S. Representative Matt Gaetz directed against President Trump's former attorney Michael Cohen. The panel told Gaetz that he was, quote, unprofessional, reckless, and sensitive, end quote, but his conduct didn't warrant formal discipline.
No, apparently they found, you know, that he did nothing seriously wrong or nothing seriously wrong enough to take action. And Matt Gaetz has always been Donald Trump's attack dog, at least for the last several months. And so he's going to come out here in his conservative district looking better than he did before the whole situation started.
Mm-hmm. What did you make of that whole affair, Dick Batchelor?
Childish. Keep in mind what Matt did, what the congressman did, is basically said, posted something kind of intimidating and possibly threatening Michael Cohen, one of Trump's former lawyers, who, of course, testified against him. Mm-hmm. And so he basically said, you know, Mr. Cohen, your family is going to be ruined if you do this. I mean, it's unbecoming, it's prattle, childish. The bar says it's not a violation of the code of ethics. It certainly is a violation of the code of ethics, notwithstanding the bar.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like there are sort of two Matt Gaetzes? There is the Matt Gaetz on Twitter, and then there is Matt Gaetz, the legislator, the lawmaker. Are there two different kind of personalities here?
No. I think they're the same. He's really a little Trumpet, and he likes to tweet, and he likes to be very verbose and caustic in his attacks. But as Matt Gaetz, his father is quite different. His father was a former Senate president, quite a moderate, and really got a lot of stuff done. In fact, it pushed very hard on the Constitutional Amendment to restrict the ability to for former legislators to lobby, those kind of things. So it's a little bit of a contradiction maybe there with the father and the son.
It's interesting how different they are.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They are. But Matt Gaetz is definitely hardcore, you know, a Trump follower.
Right. There are some sort of glimmers of bipartisanship, though, right, Frank Torres? I mean, I think back to the action that the governor took on medical marijuana. Matt Gaetz was there front and center.
Yes.
You had John Morgan, the trial lawyer and very prominent contributor to Democratic causes there as well. So some interesting kind of alliances there, too.
Yeah, he'll be all Trump and, you know, and a lot of, you know, right conservative policies. And then one morning he'll see something that hits him a different way and he'll side with that policy. So there are anomalies in his behavior, but I've been following this guy. Me and Dick followed his dad, and you know, and early on in the legislature, he's always been this kind of, you know, very noisy personality, and it's not going anywhere. So mm-hmm. it's gonna be interesting to see how his career evolves.
But he's speaking to, Frank. I agree with Frank. He's speaking to his district. I mean, that district is a red meat district, and he likes some of the red meat, and they like getting it.
Mm-hmm. Let's just stay with presidential politics for a little bit, if we could. So a couple of weeks ago, the president was scheduled to be visiting the villages. That visit was postponed in the aftermath of a couple shootings. So the president didn't make that trip. Frank Torres, you would expect him to reschedule, though, right? I mean, the villages is a demographic that the Republican Party and this president in particular seems to be speaking to.
Yeah, he'll reschedule, and I was surprised that it took him as long as he did to cancel that visit. I mean, none of those votes in the villages are going anywhere else except for Donald Trump in 2020, or at least the majority of them anyways. So he didn't lose any support by canceling. He'll go back there, whether it's next month or next year, and he'll have the same kind of turnout, and it'll continue to be a stronghold for his kind of voters moving into the next election.
Mm-hmm. Dick Batchelor, are you anticipating anything different in the lead up to this election as far as the campaign goes and what we are likely to see in rallies and campaign appearances from this president?
Well, it's interesting, you know, he did miss the villages rally for very good reason with the shootings, but he did have a rally after that in another state. And what I found fascinating, though, is that, you know, you want to, if you're a candidate, particularly if you're a incumbent, you want to re-elect me on my record, and my record is good. But he basically said to the crowd, you know, the economy is so good, even if you hate me, you should vote for me. That's not a very good campaign theme, right? Mm-hmm. Even if you hate me, vote for me. So the point is that I think he's trying to solidify the base, but he's trying now to get beyond the base. The base is, look, 95% of Republicans still support Donald Trump. So he's got 38%, 36% of the voters are there, but now he's trying to get beyond the base. So, but what your approach is, like, you might not like anything I've done. You might hate me, but the economy is good. Vote for me. That doesn't look good on a bumper sticker.
And you know you're right. That is a lousy campaign slogan, a lousy bumper sticker. But that's the way I think a lot of voters might swing if the directions, if the winds stay the same, if they get a progressive with, you know, too many far-reaching ideas that might frighten them a little bit. They might look at their bank accounts and they might, you know, check the box for him. So, yeah, it's a lousy campaign slogan, but there might be a lot of voters going that way.
And he'll stay focused on the economy, but, you know, look, there are some hints from some about a recession that may or may not happen. It may not, and if it does, it might be long-term, sometime down the road. But having that conversation, though, and on the trade issue, well, very specifically here on there are all of his spokespersons right there basically saying, notwithstanding the tariffs we imposed on China, it doesn't have any effect on the wage earner. Mm-hmm. Of course it does, because if you impose a tariff, they're going to pass it along, and it's going to be calculated in whatever you buy in this country. And that's why, admittedly, they decided to extend the tariff application until after, you know, shopping season, Christmas shopping season. So anyway, they're going to stay focused on the economy, but now they're all shifting a little bit, almost like a defensive mode, and you don't want to be in that mode either.
What do you make of that, Frank, kind of looking at the economic signs there? I mean, hints that there could be a recession on the horizon. I mean, how much of a sea anchor is that going to be on this president?
You know, when it comes to recessions and economic cycles, I tend to listen to the economists more than the politicians. You look at the cycles. We were up on a cliff, and now you might see a little bit of a downturn. It's just the way that things go, you know, as far as the economy flows and the way business works. And, you know, the timing of this thing will play very heavily in the mind of voters. And there will be some decisions that Trump makes that will be pointed to by voters on whether he's aiding it along or doing more to prevent it. Mm-hmm. So we're due. We're just about getting there again if you look at the cycles over the last several years with your peaks and your troughs. And we're going to see what he does to try to, you know, delay or try to make it or try to lessen the blow.
Yeah, and there is a burden on the Democrats, too. So let me go ahead and confess this is a burden. And that is, you know, I've been watching the debates. It's like America's Got Talent. Not. It's just.
So you're saying you're not really blown away by any of the candidates?
Well, no, actually, what I'm saying is that we need to whittle down the field so people can start contrasting the mess or Democratic measures of position with the incumbent. You got a guy now, Wang, wants to give everybody $1,000. That's his entire platform. You've got a congresswoman who met with Assad in Syria. I mean, these people are running for president so they can say they ran for president. They have no opportunity. And the threshold of a 1.4 poll, consistent poll, should be maybe change to 2% or 3% or something like that. You want to give people a chance to get out there and, you know, show their credentials. But the fact is the credentials being shown by a number of these candidates are unimpressive, sophomoric, and they need to get off the stage and whittle it down to four Democratic candidates. So at least you can start juxtaposing their position to Frank's point against the incumbent's position. But right now with the 20 candidates, you can't not do that. So we need to revise the America's Got Talent schedule for the Democratic debates.
Frank Torres, what would your advice be to this swath of candidates? I mean, do you think Dick Batchelor's ideas there about you want to be able to capture some of those voters in the middle, is that a winning strategy? Or are we in new territory and the old ideas just have to be thrown out here?
I think we're kind of in new territory. I mean, there are some really progressive ideas out there, and there's this tug of war going on in the Democratic Party between progressive values and electability. I think that the entire party likes a lot of the ideas they're throwing out, but they're looking at some of these, you know, these bigger, more far stretching ideas, and wondering, can we get this person elected? Will the independents go for this kind of brand of change? And I think we saw that last year with Andrew Gillum a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think Andrew Gillum kind of was moving a little bit too fast for your independents. And then when you start throwing out big dollar figures, that really sets off a lot of alarms in the minds of voters, whether they're, you know, applicable on a household basis or not. So that is a seesaw kind of, a balancing act that this Democratic field will have to navigate in order to find the nominee.
The concerns of Florida voters, does that translate to the rest of the country? I mean, obviously economic concerns are relevant whatever state you're in, but are there some things things that are unique about Florida that make this maybe an interesting state to campaign in, and something, a place where your strategy here may not work in Iowa or Washington State or wherever else?
Absolutely. I still believe Florida is the most unique place to campaign and still the most important voters in the world. It's essentially three states with how many media markets? Seven or eight media markets?
At least eight media markets, and you're right, it's several states.
Right, so it's a tough state to campaign in because of the size of it.
And expensive. Yes. And let me tell you, the listeners, they're still the most important voters in the world, and there's so many different ideas and backgrounds and cultures. You've got to have a far-reaching message that hits everybody.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things to me is that one of the issues that's going to be debated is the race, the issue of race. And if you saw the 1619 Project that New York Times did over the weekend, kind of revisiting the issue of slavery in this country, and already the president's tweeted, it's another fake news kind of a deal. So that is going to be interesting. If you come from the left, the whole discussion about race, then you've got some people like Senator Harris saying, reparations for whatever amount, and then Marianne Williamson, right. So it should be such a, to the point of, forget, set aside the reparations, but the whole issue of race, whether it's a criminal justice reform, as Bernie Sanders put out again over the weekend, or whether it's education, whether it's integration, or whether it's busing, the race issue is now probably on the agenda for the first, well, other than when Barack Obama ran, it was obviously on display, but since the Nixon administration, the race issue would probably be a prominent issue more than it's been since the Nixon administration.
What about immigration? And I'm wondering if some of what you're saying now sort of ties into that. I mean, immigration is at the forefront of a lot of conversations politically right now.
Yes.
Florida, of course. There's the Homestead Detention Center to keep in mind. There was news not too long ago that Health and Human Services was kind of exploring other options for places to open centers to house unaccompanied minors, including Central Florida.
Right.
It's kind of a hot-button issue. How Very important is that going to be?
I think if you look at a broader band definition of a race of people of color, not only African-Americans but Hispanics, and the whole issue with this administration on putting children in cages and not taking good care of them while they're in our, quote, possession, so to speak, in transit, is very, very controversial. But on the other hand, we get back again to where the Democrats got to be careful when it basically said, do you think all undocumented immigrants, who are here illegally, should be given rights? Then people are throwing up their hands without any explanation. You got to be very careful on that issue. But, yeah, immigration would definitely be a major, major issue.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts, Frank?
I think immigration and race do get tied in together. And let me tell you something. You better have your message straight. Because if you're clumsy over immigration, when it gets tied into racial matters, the bridge is going to collapse around you. You're going to lose support from both sides. Mm-hmm. And I think that having a straight message on immigration and having a plan, something that addresses the concerns of voters that want a structured immigration system, the system's broken. Some people that want something that properly repairs the system without allowing too much, of an open border mentality, that kind of plan is what voters will be hungry for when it comes to next year's election.
Does that seem like a one administration deal, or is it something that you would have to take like 12 years to accomplish?
Nothing ever seems to be a one administration deal anymore. And I think it will take several years to accomplish, especially if this climate in D.C. continues. If things stay exactly the same and you've got people that aren't willing to move, then none of it gets accomplished. But as far as winning over the minds and the votes of the country, you got to have a plan that really hits all the angles and doesn't move too far in one direction or the other.
And keep in mind, you got Steve Miller, the advisor in the White House, down. He's extremely right wing on this issue, in my opinion. He was one of the people who, as a young wonderkind, helped torpedo the Gang of Eight, Democrat Republican position,
which
on
Senator Rubio was part of,
which could have passed that time. But you've got some, they're galvanized on this issue, and Steve Miller, the spokesman for the president on this issue, is just very hardcore anti-immigration. You start there and then try to weed something out of that.
Are you both looking forward to this presidential election? I mean, we're not quite a year out yet.
Oh, well, I've got my antacid, I've got my Pepto-Bismol, I'm ready.
I'm ready too, but I'm really concerned. I mean, the country's in a real divisive place right now. We're seeing everywhere. I think thankfully, Central Florida has been, you know, still remains relatively unified. But, you know, these politics, the more they creep into our households and the more everybody starts, you know, the more as we start seeing the advertising and the different ideas, it's really important that the community tries to stay together and tries to get through this thing as peacefully as possible.
Let me make Frank nervous and agree with him. I think it's going to be the most caustic negative campaign in the history of this country. It is going to be so bad. And now that you've got the social media platforms where basically anything can go out uncensored, the attacks are going to be brutal, they're going to be nasty, and the closer the race gets. And we still haven't resolved how to keep the Russian influence out of this.
Well, Dick Batchelor is a Democratic political commentator. Thank you so much, Dick.
Thank you very much.
And we're also joined by Frank Torres, Republican political commentator. Thank you as well, Frank.
Thank you so much.
Still to come on Intersection, a passenger van-sized spacecraft is on a heck of a road trip. OSIRIS-REx is currently orbiting an asteroid nearly 100 million miles away. The souvenir it's looking to bring back, a scoop of dirt. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. A spacecraft the size of a passenger van is orbiting an asteroid nearly 100 million miles away, and it will soon snag a sample of dirt from the surface and send it back to Earth. OSIRIS-REx launched from Cape Canaveral nearly 3 years ago. The mission is NASA's first asteroid sample return. Scientists hope the ancient asteroid will hold signs of early life in the solar system, but since the spacecraft's arrival, the asteroid hasn't exactly been what scientists expected. 90.7 Space reporter Brendan Byrne spoke with the mission's principal investigator, Dante Loretta, about the mission and the surprises uncovered at the asteroid Bennu.
Well, Dante Loretta, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
So it's been 3 years since OSIRIS-REx launched. First of all, how's the spacecraft doing?
The OSIRIS-REx spacecraft is in tip-top shape. It has performed phenomenally, exceeding our expectations and our requirements. And we have a very capable vehicle, which is good news because we have a very challenging asteroid.
Let's talk about that. Paint us a picture. What does Bennu look like? What do we know about it now?
So asteroid Bennu is a near-Earth object. That's the target of our mission, and our primary objective is to return a sample from its surface. And a lot of what we knew about this asteroid from our ground-based and space-based astronomical telescopes turned out to be correct. It's got this really interesting spinning top shape. I often say it looks like an octahedron, or if you're a game player, an eight-sided dice. And that we knew. We had that from radar observations from the ground, and Bennu definitely has that really fascinating shape. What we had predicted was that the surface was pretty smooth. We were expecting kind of a gravel-rich environment, lots of particles on the scale of a centimeter or so. And that is not what we found. In fact, Bennu is very rugged and rough with lots and lots of large boulders, as large as a football stadium down to sizes of cars, are scattered all over the surface of this object, presenting a real challenge for us to get down and collect a sample.
And Dante Loretta, give me a sense of where Bennu and the spacecraft are right now. How far away are we talking?
We are currently about 14 light minutes away, which is the way that I think of distance when you're talking to a spacecraft. And a good rule of thumb is that it takes about 8 minutes for light to get from the sun to the Earth. So since we're about 14 minutes away, it takes almost twice that distance. So it's getting onto the other side of the solar system right now. So we're talking all the way across our orbit and then almost another orbital radius to the other side.
Does that make a challenge running this mission, that there's obviously some latency when you're sending commands or getting data back from OSIRIS-REx?
We knew that that was going to be the case, so we certainly designed the mission and the spacecraft to operate under those conditions. We are getting farther away, so one thing that means is our data rate is going to drop. So we were over a megabit per second on downlink, and now that's dropping to about 600 kilobits per second, so almost a 50% reduction in our data volume. So that's an impact. We can't take as many images and can't get data back as much volume as we were before. And it does mean that the sampling sequence is going to be autonomous. So we're basically going to program the spacecraft from orbit departure down to surface contact, sample acquisition, and back away. We'll all be on board. And because of the rugged nature, we're trying to get into some pretty tight spots on the surface. The spacecraft's going to have an autonomous image-based guidance system. So it's actually going to be taking images and adjusting its trajectory on its own as it heads down to get that sample.
And Dante Loretta, I'm also reminded of another surprise that you all discovered when you first arrived there. The asteroid was actually spewing particles into space, right?
That's right. Bennu is what we call an active asteroid. That was the jaw-dropping moment for me. I will never forget that day. We were actually in the middle of a science team meeting, so we had over 100 team members gathered in our auditorium. We were going through our initial data and the challenge of getting a sample. And my astronomy lead, Carl Hergenrother, waves me over during a break, and he shows me this image. And I look at it, and I was like, "What is that, a cosmic ray? What's going on?" He's like, "I'm pretty sure Bennu's erupting." So we started a dedicated monitoring campaign, and in fact, Bennu ejects particles on a regular basis. We're still going through all the data. In fact, I'm revising a manuscript right now on the initial science campaign to understand the phenomena. And we don't exactly know what the mechanism is. We have some leading contenders, but we're still trying to sort that out. And it's turned out to be a great science opportunity because we can track these particles. Some of them leave the asteroid and they go into interplanetary space. But a lot of them are sticking around and they're either on like a suborbital trajectory where they go up and they come back down and hit the surface, or they stay in orbit for days and we're able to track them as they orbit around Bennu. And that gives us a free probe of the gravity field because they're getting really close to the surface, much closer than the spacecraft is most of the time. So we're actually getting a lot of extra science about the gravity of this asteroid as a result of this phenomenon.
I mean, it just seems like this is the definition of discovery and exploration, right? You had some sense of what you were going to find when you get there, and now there's just this swath of new data and information that's coming back to you. It's got to be incredible to be on that science team.
We are very fortunate and we're very proud to be on this program, and it's an honor for me to be able to lead it. Absolutely. It is a great scientific expedition. We're exploring the unknown. We're entering new terrain and we're getting surprised, but we have a great spacecraft that's very capable and we have a very clever team that knows how to deal with the unknown. And so we're all actually enjoying the challenge. I have to admit, it's something that the thrill of solving the problem and knowing the team is capable of solving the problem and working through the details is exhilarating.
So you're now working through four sample sites and you're narrowing it down to one sample site. Can you tell us a bit about what you need to have at these sites in order for OSIRIS-REx to get close enough to deploy its arm and you know, collect some of that dirt that's on the surface? What are you looking at in these sites?
So the original design was that we thought we would have areas that were about 25 meter radius, so pretty big, right? So half a football field of a target area on the surface of the asteroid. We're dealing with things that are about 5 to maybe 7 or 8 meters in radius, so much smaller areas that we have to target. And what we're looking for are areas that are basically free of hazards, which are large rocks, right? We need to get our robotic arm, which has an air filter at the end of it, we need to get that air filter down onto the surface in contact with grains that are centimeter scale or smaller. So that's what we're really looking for, flat areas that look like they have the fine grain material that would be safe place to send the spacecraft down to the surface and where we think it will collect a lot of material. And those are there. We see them. We haven't gotten down to centimeter scale images yet. That's what the next phase is all about. But the areas we picked are the best options on the surface that look like they're free of boulders, relatively flat, and have a high probability of that sub-centimeter material being there.
So you imaged the entire asteroid and found these four sites that could possibly meet the criteria, and now the job of the team is to photograph and analyze these sites in even more detail and make your final selection, right?
Yeah, so our global imaging campaign is complete. We got full coverage of the asteroid from multiple lighting conditions. You know, we look at it from different angles. Sometimes you want shadows, sometimes you don't want shadows, depending on what you're trying to measure. The spectrometers have fully mapped the surface. Our laser altimeter, which was provided by the Canadian Space Agency, has completed its global mapping campaign. And those data are amazing. There should be a press release about those coming up here in the next week or so. And so all of the global nature of the asteroid is fully understood. And we were getting pictures with a pixel size of about 5 centimeters. So kind of like maybe smaller than a baseball, mm-hmm. are the kinds of things that we could see on the surface at a single pixel scale. And now we're going to get down to about centimeter scale on the pixel level. So 5 times increase in resolution. And we've done this several times during the approach phase and the preliminary survey. You know, we were getting things like 30 centimeters per pixel. And then you get down to 5 and it's like you just put your glasses on and everything looks sharp and in focus. And we're going to see that again now at the site-specific level. We can't map the asteroid at that centimeter scale. It would just take too many images and too much time. So we have to pick these areas of interest to get the high-resolution data. And ultimately, we're going to continue to do that. We're going to get down to a primary and backup site, and we're going to look at those at millimeter scales to really find the very best single location on the asteroid where we want to target the spacecraft for sample collection.
And when do you hope to have that final site selected by?
We think by the end of this year, we're going to spend the month of October getting the high-resolution data at the centimeter scale on all 4 sites, and the team has all of November to process the data, and we'll sit down in probably the first week of December and look at all that information and then make a selection on the primary site and also a backup site in case we need a second attempt and we disturb the surface during the first attempt for some reason. And then we will spend early spring of 2020 going to even lower altitudes, getting higher resolution data, getting confidence in our ability to target a specific region. And sample collection will be summer or fall of 2020, depending on how all of that work goes.
What's the next big milestone for this mission, Dante?
Getting the data from Recon A, that's a big milestone for us. So right now we are sitting in orbit. And we're kind of far away. We're back up at the initial orbital altitude where we range between 1.6 and 2.1 kilometers from the surface. And we're doing particle monitoring. That's kind of a easy activity for us to do during quiet times. Just take a bunch of pictures. And we're still seeing particle events, ejections coming from the surface. They've pretty much continued. Every time we start looking, we see another one. And then we leave orbit and we're doing passes over the surface at a little over a kilometer. So that'll be the closest non-orbital trajectory that we will have performed. And we're going to do that for 4 weeks in a row, 1 site per week. And then getting that data down and making the primary site decision based on that. That's really the big milestone in terms of bringing in NASA headquarters, running them through all of our data and our thought process and getting their concurrence on our decision for the primary site. That should be early December.
And Dante, when you do collect that sample and return it to Earth, what are you hoping to find? What questions do you have that you're hoping this mission will answer?
So when you look at asteroid samples, you're really looking at the oldest rocks in the solar system. So we're basically geologists, and we're trying to piece together the story of how planets formed, how our solar system formed, and particularly why is the Earth habitable, and why did the origin of life occur here? So we chose Bennu because we felt it was going to be rich in water, which turned out to be true, probably rich in organic material, and we'll be learning more about that. We are collecting spectral data that could indicate the presence of organics, especially during these low-altitude recon passes. So we're interested in what did carbon do in the early solar system, how much organic chemistry took place inside asteroids, and what kind of molecules that we know are important for biology, like amino acids and nucleic acids and phosphates and sugars that make up our biomolecules, how much of that chemistry happened even before the Earth existed? And did these kinds of asteroids deliver those to the Earth and maybe help catalyze the origin of life here? Because if that's the case, then these compounds got all over the place. They got to Mars, they got to Europa, they got to Titan, to Enceladus. All these places that we think are likely to be habitable probably also had the building blocks of life, and our search for life in the solar system just got a lot more likely to pay off.
And finally, Dante, Loretta, you've spent 14 years on this mission, and the finish line is in sight. Is there a little sadness knowing that this is almost over?
Well, we still got a lot of work ahead of us, so I don't have time to be sad. So, no. And, you know, the sample's coming back in 2023, so that's still 4 years out, which compared to 14 years doesn't sound like a long time, but that's a person's college career, so it's still a lot of time ahead of us. And then it doesn't end when the samples are back on Earth. Really, the science just gets started there because we're all about sample analysis, and the mission goes for 2 more years in the sample analysis phase. So I'm not done till 2025. I've still got 6 years as the active OSIRIS-REx PI. That's a long time, and I'm enjoying the ride.
Wonderful. Well, we've been speaking to Dante Loretta. He's the principal investigator of the OSIRIS-REx mission. Dante, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure, Brendan. Thanks for having me.
90.7 Space reporter Brendan Byrne with that interview. You can find out more about the OSIRIS-REx asteroid mission and other space exploration efforts by subscribing to our podcast, Are We There Yet? Up next, a fraternity on a quest to get young black high school students to graduate high school and go on to college. We're back in a minute with a conversation with Alpha Phi Alpha. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity was founded more than 100 years ago. Fraternity brothers include the likes of Duke Ellington and Thurgood Marshall, and the fraternity is active today in helping steer young black men towards college through a program called Go to High School, Go to College. I sat down with incoming vice president of the Central Florida chapter of Alpha Phi Alpha, Rodney Rackley, to talk about the fraternity's focus on higher education. Rodney Rackley, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, sir.
So this program, Go to High School, Go to College, has been around for a long time, 100 years now, right?
Yes. In 1919, at a convention in Chicago, Illinois, someone had the wisdom to actually recommend the program. The convention voted on it and approved it, and we started the program in 1919 in Chicago. Those guys way back then, they had a vision, you know, for, you know, improving the lives of African-American families or black families. And I think that still stands true today, that if you, as an African-American man, go to high school, graduate, go to college and graduate, you're going to be able to improve the life of your family.
Mm-hmm. And so tell me a little bit about how the program works. Do you go to high schools and in the last couple of years and give them information about what they need to do to stay in school, essentially, and beyond?
Okay. Our program, the Go to High School, Go to College program is our national program. But on the local level, we have a program that we call the Young Men of Distinction program. And every year in August, we have recruitment efforts where we let all the schools know that we're recruiting students, mm-hmm, grade 7th through 12th. And it's a 10-month program. And those students will, every month, we'll have at least two touches with those students. And one of the touches is a module. And the modules is like they'll come together on an afternoon, and we'll have someone come in and give them a speech, or they'll go on a field trip to a certain history museum or whatever the topic may be. But the modules are based on four principles. So it's academic, leadership, personal, and social development. I really think that the first three tenets, the academic, the leadership, and the personal development, is really what makes our program really effective.
Just reading a little bit about graduation rates in Florida, at least, there was a story published by the Orlando Sentinel last December talking about the graduation rate, and it's actually going up as far as, you know, the graduation rate was 3.8 percentage points higher in 2017 and up 23.4 points from a decade ago. And talking about percentage of black and Hispanic students graduating on time, that has also gone up. So is history kind of on your side here as far as graduation rates, or do you still feel like there are some challenges that that you need to overcome to get more black students graduating and going on to college?
And those stats that you gave are right in line with the Florida Department of Education, mm-hmm, have on their website. When you look at those stats, they're very positive because each of those categories are improving every year. One of the things that we also notice is that when you dig down into the numbers, African Americans are still dropping out at a higher rate than, you know, some of the other categories mm-hmm. at this time.
Why is that?
There's different reasons. And I actually, you know, a lot of them deal with family structure. Mm-hmm. Some of them may be families relocating or, you know, having different financial challenges. And I read somewhere that sometimes students drop out because they cannot complete the assignments. So rather than be shown a failure, they drop out so no one sees them fail. So there's different reasons why people will drop out. But for African-American men, a lot of times I'll say the main reason may be family structure and economics probably.
Mm-hmm. So is mentorship part of that then? Can you overcome some of those challenges? You know, if you're dealing with a student who does come from a background where they may not have the kind of family support they need to get through high school and then college, like, can you help them overcome some of those things by putting some people in place who can sort of show them the way?
Our Young Men of Distinction program, the majority, at least half of the students in our program come from single family homes.
Single parent homes?
Yes. So there may be a mother in the home and she's like, I want my son in your program so you can help him to matriculate through middle school, high school, and on to college.
So the parents are reaching out to you?
They are.
Mm-hmm. How do they find out about the fraternity and what it does?
Well, we students start each year in the program, and we go out into the local community when they have they'll have the back to school, mm-hmm. the back to school backpack giveaways. We'll show up at those types of activities, and we'll hand out information on our program. And then what we do is we go to high schools when they have open houses and information fairs. We go to local community centers. And then we also have a network. And I can take a flyer with information on our program, and I'll send it to five different people that we're having an informational meeting on this date at this time. And within those five people, they'll disperse it to another five people. And it's like a network of people that will disperse this information out for you. And, you know, you have your informational meeting and you have 30 people show up for the meeting because they've sent it out to these different parents in different areas. And if they need the services, they'll find you.
There is a bit of a push at the moment in Florida to kind of have people who may not be so interested in college, have, you know, high school graduates who may be not so interested in college, find other opportunities, whether it's a trade school or an apprenticeship. Where does your fraternity stand on that? Like, do you also encourage high school graduates to seek out those opportunities too? Or you purely focused on college?
There's young men that are in our program that are when you meet them, you know, you can, you know, and you start talking with them. Some guys are centered and are focused on going to college. Some guys are not as focused. Their mom said, I want you in this program.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do is we try to give the guys the opportunity and exposure to what is available to them. A lot of guys may be focused on, I can't make it to college. But then when they come into program and what we find is when they come into the program and they're interacting with a lot of other guys that may be interested in going to college, they start to think, maybe I can go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And then we take them on college tours and they go to see all these different schools. And they may go to one school and say, you know what? I can see myself in this school. So one of the things that we try to do is expose them to what they can possibly grow to. Some students will decide, and in our program, which was one of the things that we've had to do over the last 10 years or so, is it's pretty much admit to ourselves that some of these students may be more so geared toward they want to go to the military.
Mm-hmm.
Or some of them would like to go to a trade school. And we understand that. But our focus is always on if you go to college and graduate, you're going to come out probably at a higher stance or in a better situation than if you look at the other alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
So we focus on the college, but we understand that everybody may not go to college.
Mm-hmm. And you have some scholarship programs to help students too, right? Because that is another concern for students of any background is how do they deal with college debt, right? I mean, the goal of going to college, it's something that a lot of people aspire to, but on the other end of it, they're like, what am I going to do when I come out of college if I have this mountain of debt and I may be, you know, in a field where job prospects are, you know, there's a lot of competition for jobs. So how am I going to get around that?
One of the things that we do with our program, our mentoring program, is during those 10 modules that we do during the year, at least one of those modules is going to focus on, like, financial aid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have modules that focus on college admissions. And then we have modules focused on financial aid. And what we do is when we talk to the students, we talk to them about budgeting.
Mm-hmm.
And when you show them that, you know what, if you graduate with a GPA at this range and you have SAT scores or ACT scores at this range, you can possibly get a full scholarship
mm-hmm.
to go to college. And then we have workshops where we teach them to fill out the college applications and the scholarship applications. And I actually do a module with the students, and I explain to them, it could take you 30 minutes to complete a scholarship application. And if you do that scholarship application and you win a scholarship for $1,000, how much time did it take for that $1,000?
Mm-hmm.
You could go work at a local grocery store and make $10 an hour. How many hours you have to work to earn that same $1,000?
Mm-hmm.
So the economics and the reality is you could spend time working on your scholarship applications, and if you win enough of those scholarship applications, you won't have to worry about graduating with student loans. And student loans are a necessity for some.
Mm-hmm.
But we try to train our guys that you don't want to graduate with student loans. That's like having another burden on you when you graduate.
Mm-hmm.
So we want them to get scholarships, and we work with them to get scholarships. And we even encourage some of our guys, if you would like to go to a university but you don't have a scholarship, you may need to consider going to a local community college and get a scholarship at that level and then transfer to a university versus going to that university and having to take out student loans to pay for your schooling.
Rodney Rackley, when you were contemplating college, do you feel like you had all the sort of know-how to kind of figure all this stuff out, or did you have to learn that the hard way by yourself?
I was a first-generation college student for my family.
Mm-hmm.
And when I actually went to college, my first choice was to go in the military. And there was a college way back when. There was a college night at Valencia Community College. And I went to Valencia just because they said, oh, there's a college night at Valencia. So I went to it. I walked in. I'm walking around looking at all the schools. And I met a gentleman from UCF. And he asked me a few questions, asked me about my grades, what I want to do. He said, why don't you apply for UCF? So I went through the motions.
Mm-hmm.
I did my work. I completed my application. And lo and behold, I got a letter in the mail. I got accepted to UCF. So I'm like, okay, I'll go to UCF and I'll give it a shot. And when I got on campus at UCF, I made a lot of mistakes. So what I'm trying to do is, with the mistakes that I've made, we can turn around now and share it with these young people that are coming after us.
Mm-hmm.
When I graduated, I probably had about $18,000 in student loans.
Which was what year?
In 92.
Mm-hmm.
When I graduated, I was in 92. I had about $18,000 in student loans. And it took me a while to pay those off. So what I'm sharing with these young people is, you don't have to do, you know, this is what I did wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to tell you about it so you don't have to make the same mistakes. On a positive note, I have a son that's at UCF now on a full ride scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were able to share some of the things that we learned with him. So he focused even harder on his on his classes in high school. He was able to do very well on his testing and was able to get an academic scholarship and other scholarships at UCF. And pretty much full ride. So we want all our students that go through our program to have that same type of opportunity.
I guess there's probably an incentive, too, for the fraternity to have more folks going into college, right? Because that way you can have more people join the fraternity. So there's a self-fulfilling aspect to this.
What's kind of interesting is out of the guys that I know who have went through our program locally here in Orlando, mm-hmm. we have probably a 25% chance that they will ever become members of our organizations.
That's it?
That's it.
Is that something you want to turn around, though?
For us, our focus isn't on them joining Alpha Phi Alpha. Mm-hmm. Our focus is on them matriculating from high school, matriculating through college, and then coming back into this community or whatever community they're in and having a positive impact. Mm-hmm. You know, so for us, if you happen to become an alpha, it's a plus. But our main goal is that they're going to come back and benefit their local community and benefit their family.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of response have you had this year from, you know, your outreach to high schools and talking to, you know, high school kids? Like, what's the feedback been?
Glad you asked. Our informational meeting is coming up on this Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll have our first meeting with, we have a list of at least, I have a list of at least like 10 parents that reached out to me that want to invite their son to be in our program. So they'll be at our meeting on this coming Sunday, and we'll share information on the program and our goals and objectives for this year.
Mm-hmm.
And our theme for this year is Flight 2020. And once we take off, you know, we hope that we'll have all these young men on board and we'll be able to blaze through the next 10 months with them. And get them ready, get the ones that are in high school. And one of the challenges that that we work on is we found statistics that show if you can get the guys there in the 7th, 8th, 9th grade, if you can get them through the 10th grade, there's a good chance that they'll go ahead and go off to college. So we're working really hard with those on the lower end to make sure they get past 10th grade, because if you can get that mindset by the time they're in the 10th grade and they pass 10th grade, there's a good chance they're going to go off to college.
And where is that informational session?
On this Sunday at 3 o'clock, it's going to be at Shiloh Baptist Church, which is in Orlando, Florida, on Jackson Street, right downtown. And we'll be having a meeting starting at 3. It'll go from 3 until about 4:30.
Mm-hmm.
And we're inviting 7th through 12th graders throughout Central Florida to come out. Parents come out, get the information on the program. And then we'll follow up with that with our interviews and starting with our modules in September, October.
Well, Rodney Rackley is the incoming vice president of the local chapter of Alpha Phi Alpha here in Central Florida. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, sir.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.